not only do I get to do, you know, what I love in the place where I love, but it's the people that I love. You know, the family that I grew up around. I've got a huge extended family. My mom and my dad were from really large families, so I've got a ton of first cousins and second cousins, and they're scattered all over the reservation. So when I think about, you know, I'm going to do a job in a particular community, I think, well, you know, I've got kin folks that live there, and I'm not only doing it for that community, I'm doing it for my family. That's one thing about being Cherokee, because when you do these kinds of things, you realize that we're all family.
All right, welcome to episode 16 of Small Talk, our podcast here at Communities Unlimited. My name is Chris Baker, and joining us today is Mr. Billy Hicks. Billy is the Senior Director of the Office of Environmental Health and Engineering with the Cherokee Nation. Billy, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Chris. It's great to be here, and thank you for having me.
I appreciate you being on. Also joining us is another Communities Unlimited employee, Haley Reed. Haley, how are you?
I'm good. I'm glad to be here.
And guys, we just wanted to sit down and talk and introduce Mr. Hicks, talk about what he does for a living, talk about how the Cherokee Nation has interacted with water and wastewater, and just kind of talk about the state of things. And to get things rolling, I guess I should tell you as well, Billy, you are on the Communities Unlimited board.
Yes, that is correct. I have been on the board for a few years now and really enjoy it.
And then also, are you still on the board at RCAP?
I am. I will probably, if they will have me, will be starting my last 3-year term as an at-large board member in a couple of weeks.
Safe to say, you deal with water and wastewater a lot.
I do. I deal with it on many fronts. I dealt with it here for about 20 years, you know, give or take, and then joined the RCAP board, and then later joined the CU board. And so I've been dealing with it on just a little different scale and a little different perspective in those two roles. But it basically all boils down to trying to help rural communities with their water and wastewater issues.
And I guess we should really zoom out for just a second and start with, can you introduce us, Billy, to the Cherokee Nation and tell everybody, if they're unfamiliar, what it is, size, those kind of information?
Sure. So the Cherokee Nation is up in the northeast corner of Oklahoma, and our reservation encompasses all or part of 14 counties. I think there's 6 counties that are completely inside the reservation, and there's 8 counties that are partially inside the reservation. And within that reservation, you know, we encompass part of the Tulsa metropolitan area. So there's a large population, and I want to say there's around 60,000 or so Cherokee tribal members that live inside the reservation. And then, of course, there are other tribal members from other tribes that live inside the reservation as well. Like from our perspective, with the program that we administer through Indian Health Service, we service not only the Cherokee citizens who live in the reservation, but also all of the federally recognized tribes that live inside the reservation. So we serve everywhere from, you know, the Cherokees that live here, but Choctaws, Chickasaws, Muscogee, you know, there's a lot of small tribes up by Miami in the very northeast corner of Oklahoma, but a lot of them live on our side of the boundary. So we serve those tribal members up in that corner as well. In a typical year, our department probably serves about 600 to 700 homes with various different services on water and wastewater. And, you know, the vast majority of those are Cherokees, but then we do serve other tribal members as well.
So why water and wastewater for yourself? How did you get involved and why, I guess?
Well, you know, thinking back on it, my childhood, I was a science nerd. There was just no easy way to put it. I love science. I grew up before the internet, so I consumed PBS and shows like Nova and Nature. And there was a show that used to come on PBS called Connections, and it was a BBC series. And I don't know if any of you ever seen it, but it was just the coolest show, and I just ate it up. And so when I was in high school, I had a chemistry teacher who was a retired Army officer, and his name was Tim Bodine, and he really instilled that love of science, especially chemistry and physics, in me. And so when I graduated high school, I went to college and graduated with a degree in chemistry. Well, while I was in school, I was working my way through school. I got the opportunity to come to work for the Cherokee Nation as a dispatcher for the Emergency Medical Services Program, and actually worked my way through school while I was actually working nights and weekends on an ambulance and working in the dispatch center. Well, when I graduated and got my degree, there was a job that came open in the Cherokee Cherokee Nation Environmental Department, and I applied for that program and was selected and transferred from the EMS program over to the environmental program, and I've been here ever since. It's going on almost 29 years now. I just love this work. I love working for the Cherokee Nation. My parents are both from the Cherokee Reservation, and it gave me the opportunity to make a difference in my home community and to, you know, live around my family and not have to move off to some urban environment in some far off, region of the country and try to make a living. And I was able to do that here. And it's really been beneficial to me and to my family. And I just love it.
I find that within, you know, the tribal nations, there is a desire to give back to that community. Is that part of it for you?
It is. It's a big part of it, because not only do I get to do, you know, what I love in the place where I love, but it's the people that I love. You know, the family that I grew up around. I've got a huge extended family. My mom and my dad were from really large families, so I've got a ton of first cousins and second cousins, and they're scattered all over the reservation. So when I think about, you know, I'm going to do a job in a particular community, I think, well, you know, I've got kinfolks that live there, and I'm not only doing it for that community, I'm doing it for my family. That's one thing about being Cherokee, because when you do these kinds of things, you realize that we're all family. And I'm sure if Haley and I sit down and talk long enough, we'd realize we probably have common kinfolk and ancestors at some point.
There's all the time you find people are related and you're like, oh.
Well, Haley, I guess I want to bring you in now and let you ask a couple of the questions that you had.
I know you were talking a lot about, you know, your family, but also I know in our culture, water is sacred. You know, water or ama in Cherokee is really something that I was taught to be respectful of, and to whenever I come into a body of water, that I need to leave it cleaner than when I came. Does that have any play into what you do and why you did it?
It does. It has a big impact on me. When I, you know, came into this world, my parents had to move to Tulsa to find work, and as a lot of Cherokee families did, there weren't a lot of opportunities in those rural communities back in the, you know, in the 50s and 60s. So they had moved to Tulsa, and that's where I was born. I always remember when I was young, we would come back and visit my mom's family, and that's where my Cherokee lineage comes from, is from my mom's family. And they lived in a little house here in Cherokee County, and right behind their house was a spring. And if you know that the significance for Cherokees and water, that spring was like almost like a sacred spot. And I remember as a child going down there and seeing that spring, and I was just in awe that there was this water coming out of the side of the hill, and it was cold and it was clear and it was clean. And, you know, getting to experience that really, I think, fostered that desire to be involved in something that involved with water. Because like you said, water is life. And I don't know if this is an audio only podcast, but my shirt has that on it right here. Water is life. And that's what we believe. And that is really ingrained in everything we do.
You had the spring, and I kind of had the Illinois River. I still had family that had land right off the Illinois River, and he also had a turkey farm right there. And while his farm's no longer there, I do know that there has been growing amounts of poultry farms in the area, and with that's been kind of some growing concern about what it's doing to the water. Do you have any thoughts or anything about that?
Well, yeah, certainly water quality is a big issue, and we are certainly attuned to that, and we realize that we can't continue to exist if we let the water quality degrade to a point where it's no longer usable. And that, you know, that kind of brings up the whole concept of water security. And when I talk about water security, I'm not talking about, you know, the fences around a water treatment plant or cybersecurity. I'm talking about a concept that in order to have water security, you need three things. You need water quality, you need water quantity, and you need water equity. And those three things, if you think about a Venn diagram where those three circles converge in the center and you have all three of those elements, that's where you have water security. So if you don't have water quality, you can't have water security. By definition, you know, surface water quality, those non-point source pollution sources like poultry farms or even like, people that let their cattle get down into the river and degrade the water. You know, we like to have riparian buffer zones where we keep that kind of thing out of the river. The farmers can certainly use that water to water their cattle, but we don't want the cattle to go into the water. We want the water to go to the cattle. You know, those types of management practices and conservation measures we certainly support, because it helps them keep that water quality high. You know, when I was little, I remember going down to Lake Tenkiller, and the water was so clear you could go out on a dock and look down the water probably 15 feet deep and see the bottom. Well, you can't do that now. And a lot of that is because of the high levels of nitrates and phosphates that are in the water that support that algae growth. And now the algae in the water has got it to a point where you can't see in the water more than probably a couple of feet. And so those long-term water quality metrics are definitely always in the front of our mind and trying to keep the water quality to a point where it's usable. It's not only for, you know, drinking purpose, but for recreation and for Cherokees, you know, that cultural and spiritual perspective as well.
You're talking about what appears to be potential obstacles in water and wastewater. I'm genuinely curious because I've been with Communities Unlimited for about a year and change now. And I got to be honest, I didn't think about water or wastewater in my own life before now. It was just there. I guess my question to you is specifically with your work with the Cherokee Nation, is there any like unique obstacle situations that come up with that kind of work in the Cherokee Nation?
I don't know that we have a lot of unique obstacles. I think we have a lot of common obstacles that most communities face. Certainly, water quality that we just discussed is a big issue. We see, you know, degradation of surface water and groundwater. We also see declining amounts of water available in some areas. So, you know, we see groundwater yields going down in communities and in homes that depend on groundwater as their primary water source. So water quantity is also an issue. One of the big issues that we do face is, you know, that third element of water security is water equity. And one of the things that we really want to focus on is trying to make water affordable. Because if you have all the water in the world and it's of the highest quality, but people can't afford it, it doesn't do them any good. And so one of the issues that we want to tackle is to trying to determine, you know, what is a fair gauge of water equity. How do you measure that? How do you determine if water is affordable? You know, the EPA has a metric that they use. It's 3% of the median household income. Well, if you think about the median household income, that's the person right in the middle. Half the people make more, half the people make less. So if you're over on the right side of the curve, you're fine. But if you're way over on the left side of the curve, what's affordable for the guy in the middle may not be affordable for you. So we want to make sure that we think about those folks. And when we're doing a project planning and we're looking at, you know, a project to improve water quality or water quantity in a community, we also want to look at what it's going to do to the water equity side of that equation. We want to make sure that we maximize the grant funding that we can get for those communities to try to keep those water rates low and still have the water system be sustainable. What we've seen over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years or maybe even longer is that a lot of water systems were faced with a choice. They can keep the water affordable or they can maintain their system. And a lot of those systems, since they were governed by the folks that were trying to keep the water affordable, chose that option, and they kept their rates too low to be sustainable in the long run. And now you've seen the effects of 30 years of aging infrastructure, and they're faced now with the fact they need to replace things. Pumps have worn out. Towers need to be replaced. Water lines are too small. They don't have any money in the bank because they've had that obstacle to keep the water affordable for their citizens. And now we have to come in and try to help them find a solution to replace that infrastructure and try to help find a way to keep that affordable. You know, there's a lot of financing out there for water projects, but most of it is loan funding. And so if that water system has to take on a loan, they have to pay the loan back. Well, the water system doesn't exist without the customers. So the customers have to pay the loan back. And so if the rates go up, what suddenly was affordable for the last 20 years is no longer affordable. You know, there are federal programs to help pay for folks' broadband if they meet income qualifications. There's programs to help them pay for their heating and air conditioning and utility bills, but there's no program for water and wastewater. There was a program that was started as part of the coronavirus response effort, but it was a temporary program and it's going away. And so those folks that qualified for that and were able to get some relief on their water and wastewater bills for a few years now are going to be faced with the fact that that's gone. And so we have to try to take that into account when we're doing a project, but we also want to try to be an advocate for those folks and for those communities to think about, you know, if the federal government's going to help subsidize broadband for low-income folks and heating and electrical utility payments for low-income folks, let's think about water and wastewater as well. I know there's broadband folks at CU that may disagree. You can live without broadband. You can't live without water. And that should be the top of the needs chart right there. we need to help folks afford their water, and that will help those systems be sustainable. If they can then charge a rate that is sustainable, taking into account those subsidies that those low-income folks are going to get, then that makes that water system sustainable in the long run, which is ultimately what we're after.
Whenever I hear something like that, and I always learn something new almost daily here at Communities Unlimited, that shocks me. It seems like that's like a no-brainer, right? I don't know exactly what to do about that, but I mean, that seems like it should be easily, and hopefully, you know, there's lots of desire to get that accomplished as well.
You know, while the federal government may be kind of overlooking some of the water, wastewater things, it's always great to see that the Cherokee Nation isn't. I get the Cherokee Nation, the Cherokee Phoenix newspaper, and I follow them on social media, and I've seen some kind of legislation that's kind of caused some advancements possible, like in April of 2021, the Wilma P. Mankiller and Charlie Soapwater Act that led to at least $2 million in additional funding to aid in the efforts at eliminating barriers to clean water access in the reservation. And then again, in August of 2022, the Indian Health Services, which has been a blessing to me in many ways, but they have signed an agreement that brought $11.8 million in safe water infrastructure and sewage updates to 1,400 homes across the Cherokee Nation. How have these new acts and funds affected your work? And do you have any more information you'd like to share on how it's going now?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And if you get the Cherokee Phoenix, I don't know if you got the most recent edition yet, but we are at the top of the front page for a water project we just finished in Chewy, Oklahoma. I know we're audio only, but I was sitting here nodding my head up and down as you were reading all that. Absolutely great segue. What I wanted to get into, the Mankiller Soap Water Act, passed by the Tribal Council back in April of 2021, was a huge effort and acknowledgement on the part of the tribe to recognize the importance of water, the issues that we face in this work, and to set up a program that is going to be really instrumental in us moving forward. What the Mankiller Soap did, you mentioned the $2 million. That's probably the biggest piece. It was a tribal funded investment in water in perpetuity. Until that Mankiller Soap Act is either amended or the tribal council, you know, repeals it for some reason, that $2 million per year is going to be set aside for water and wastewater infrastructure within the Cherokee Nation. Now, what the Mankiller Soap Act did, like you said, it is for us to go out and try to identify where those barriers are. There are three primary elements that we are to do. One thing is we are to try to identify through a census process any Cherokee home that has no water at all, and then to come up with a solution to get them water as soon as possible. The second thing is we are trying to identify the number of homes across the reservation that don't have access to public water. So those are the homes that are still on wells, that may be on a cistern or using a spring, and have a water source that the EPA would consider that home to be underserved because they're not connected to a public water supply. So the second element of Mankiller Soap is for us to determine those homes. And the third thing is for us to determine the most infrastructure deficient public water systems across the reservation. Those three elements are basically what we do with the Mankiller Soap money on a reoccurring basis. We are to do that and to provide a report back to the council and administration every 2 years on those data points. And then we are to try to come up with solutions for those. So what the Mankiller Soap does, in my mind, the biggest thing is it gives us the tools to try to identify where those barriers are, to break those barriers down, and then to help water systems be more sustainable, reliable, and affordable. It was, you know, like I said, an acknowledgement of the importance of water. And since that time, we've completed our first report, which was due this last November of 2022. So we didn't have a lot of time to gather data and to write that report. So we're going through now our first full 2 year cycle, and that next report will be due in November of 2024. And we're going to have a lot more data and be able to have a lot more exhaustive report with a lot more accuracy in the recommendations that we're able to make to council. The other thing that the Act does is it also authorizes the council to make additional appropriations where they deem appropriate. So if we come back with a report that identifies some barriers that $2 million won't solve, they can then appropriate additional funds and give to us to get those solutions implemented. So it was really a huge effort on their part, and it has really changed our operations over here. We were kind of really dependent upon the federal Indian Health Service funding. We had some tribal funds, but nothing like this, nothing that really was geared toward planning and data gathering efforts that we needed to identify where the issues were and then do that. So one of the things we're doing, we're actually doing a evaluation of all the public water systems across the Cherokee Nation. There's 130 some of those, and we're going to have all of those done fairly shortly. I just looked and we're up to the 91 that we've done an evaluation on. So before this next report's due, we'll have every water system evaluated, and then we can determine which of those are the most infrastructure deficient, what it's going to take to fix that, and then be able to report that back to council, and then also take it to the federal agencies.
Did you say 130 water systems?
Yes, 100, I think there's 132, and that's just the ones that are serving populations below 25,000. You know, we're not counting like the big systems like the city of Tulsa or Bartlesville or Muskogee. We kind of feel that those bigger systems, they have large tax bases, large customer bases. They have economies of scale that the little systems don't. So we wanted to focus our efforts on the small systems. So we kind of chose that 25,000 metric as the cutoff point, knowing that probably the vast majority of our work will be in the small communities below 3,300. We have the capacity to serve up to 25,000. We're going to evaluate them to see what we find. But I think what we're going to find is the systems that are in most need have the lowest capacity development scores and the highest infrastructure needs scores are going to be the smallest systems in the reservation.
Always amazed that whenever I get to talk to someone who works in what we call at CU Environmental Services, the water and wastewater area, the variety and scope of, you know, rural water system setups. It's just shocking to me how much variety there is.
Yeah, there's a huge variety both in scope and capacity and service area. And I was thinking the other day, you know, rural Oklahoma is on the electric side is served by a handful of electric co-ops, and they serve the entire state. But across the state of Oklahoma, I think there's like 800 and some public water systems that serve less than 3,300 population. Imagine if instead of having 800 water systems, we only had about 20 or 30 large water systems that serve those rural areas. How much easier it would be for us to assess them, to assist them, and to make sure that they were sustainable. And I think eventually that's where we're going to go. And it's not going to be, you know, because of any grand effort of one person to make that happen. I think it's just going to be as time goes on, those small systems are going to realize they're going to have to regionalize and come together. There's a lot of benefit to regionalization. And I think eventually those small systems are going to come to that realization. We would like to bring them there sooner rather than later, but eventually I think it's going to happen just because of the natural order of things and the way things, go in our world. And a small system that could operate and be feasible 50 or 70 years ago is just simply not going to be that, you know, in the future. So they're going to have to come to these regional projects. And we are in the process of trying to help some of those go through that process, working with staff at CU, working with some of our local councils of government to help them come and do some feasibility studies on those regional projects to see areas that we might be able to help them partner together to be sustainable and to have a viable future.
And one of the things that I've also picked up on, and again, and I'm learning so much about water and wastewater in just the year that I've been here, regionalization, not an easy task.
It's not. You know, there's a lot of barriers to regionalization. Sometimes we go in and there's long-standing issues and disputes between communities, and we try to come in as a third party, a neutral third party, to try to help them work out those differences and realize that they're better off working together than they are trying to maintain that separation and their own individual little kingdoms. And, you know, sometimes we can get over that hill and sometimes we can't, but it doesn't mean we're not going to try. And we see the long-term benefit to regionalization, and we're definitely going to keep blowing that trumpet. And we've got big supporters at CU and at RCAP and other areas that are blowing that horn as well. And the EPA is trying to get those folks to regionalize, and there's funding available and set aside to help facilitate that and to make that happen. And we're definitely a champion of that cause and will be in the future.
I want to break in and remind everyone that we're talking to Billy Hicks. He's the Senior Director of the Office of Environmental Health and Engineering with the Cherokee Nation. He's also on the board at RCAP, and that's, if you don't know, is the Rural Community Assistance Partnership, and he's also a board member at Communities Unlimited. You are working with the Cherokee Nation Office of Environmental Health and being on Communities Unlimited's board. Is that advantageous to your work in any way?
Well, it is. It's definitely helped broaden my perspective. When I joined the RCAP board, you know, I had a good understanding of water and wastewater work. I knew about the federal programs and getting to work with RCAP. I slowly began to realize that, you know, the folks I had worked with at CU's predecessor, CRG, and then CU itself, I had a good understanding of what they did. But what I did not realize was how diverse the regions were within RCAP and the level of services that they had. And so when I became a board member of CU, then I got to see all of the other wonderful work that CU is doing in our communities, you know, small business lending and entrepreneurship and economic development and broadband and housing and all those things that rural communities need, not just water and wastewater. Being able to immerse myself in that has helped me have that broader perspective when I come into a rural community that water and wastewater may be one of their needs, but it may not be their only need. And I need to look outside of the water and wastewater sphere to see if there are other needs that may be contributing to the water and wastewater issues they're having. And then being able to work with the CU staff that can bring in those resources. And we've got a lot of programs here at the Cherokee Nation, you know, housing programs and economic development programs and commerce programs and career services and a lot of different things that we can help then bring into those communities when we see the need. So it's helped broaden my perspective for that and to, I think, be a better advocate for those rural communities when I go in there and work with them, you know, on their water and wastewater issues.
The advocacy part of it is such a big part of it for rural communities. It doesn't really matter what area you're talking about, but they need those advocates and it doesn't happen without them. I have heard more than once your name mentioned as an advocate. So kudos for that.
Thank you.
See, I heard you on the Tap Talk, and I also heard you mention CRG, our predecessor, now the Tap Talk with the Drinking Water and Rural America podcast, and they asked you who your hero was, and you said that it was George Tipton, who was a Cherokee veteran, but you met him through our predecessor, CRG. Would you like to talk about why you chose him?
Oh, I would love to. I never get tired of talking about George. When I first kind of started in this field, and my boss at the time said, I need you to start going to these water meetings and, you know, seeing what's going on in these communities and coming back and seeing if we can help them put projects together. I kept going to these meetings and I would see George, and George was there. You know, these are meetings that happen at night in these little rural communities, and it'd be the water board and their operator and maybe one or two other customers, and then it'd be me. And I'd go to this board meeting and there'd be George, and he'd be helping them talk about, you know, their needs and financing and going to rural development for money and going to the SRF for money. And I would come in and I'd say, well, you know, Cherokee Nation might be able to help you as well. We'd love to try to do that. And I started working with George, and I'd go to one meeting and George would be there, and I'd go to another meeting and George would be there. I'd say, George, I think we're going to have to get to know each other really well, because I think we're going to be working together. And so over the years, you know, that relationship really developed, and I gained a lot of respect for George. He had so much experience in this field, and he was willing to kind of take me under his wing and share a lot of that experience with me. And, you know, I wasn't aware really that he was a Cherokee veteran. You know, he didn't really talk about that until one day I was on the Cherokee Nation YouTube webpage and looking at some of the things they do. And one of the things they do is they have like a veteran spotlight where they honor a Cherokee veteran. And there was my friend George Tipton. And I was like, holy cow, it's George. And I couldn't believe, you know, that they had done that and that he had been nominated and they had chosen him to be in one of those veteran spotlights. And it was wonderful to see him. And it added to, you know, that wonderful character that I already knew about George. It just added to his mystique. I was really proud to see that. But George was a great guy, and I really enjoyed working with him. And, you know, all the folks at CU have been wonderful to work with. George and Phil Ross at the time worked with a lot of him on a lot of projects. And then Karen Conrad came and later worked with, you know, Julie and Gaylene, worked with Gaylene, you know, when she was with Rural Development. Then she retired and came to CU. So known a lot of those folks for a while, but George was the one that got it all started.
Yeah, we've definitely had some kind of water heroes here, people who've been recognized throughout. And it's really cool. That is one thing I've really loved about working with Communities Unlimited, and then seeing, oh, we're working with the Cherokee Nation. That's amazing. I love that we're helping bridge those gaps. But can you explain a little bit how CU has been bridging those gaps and bringing access to clean water and wastewater?
Absolutely. So when we go into a community, from my perspective at Cherokee Nation, you know, we go in and we help them try to first identify what the problem is. So a lot of times, you know, those small communities, in order to get any federal funding for water and wastewater, you have to have an engineering report. You have to have a cost estimate. A lot of times you'll have to have the environmental review document done, and they don't have the resources to do that. So one of the good things that we are able to do at Cherokee Nation is we can go in and we can help them. We can use some tribal funds that the council has appropriated either through the Mankiller SOPA Act or through another appropriation, and we can help them get some of that preliminary pre-construction work done. Then the folks at CU, you know, we're there with them from day one. They can then take all of that information, that engineering report, environmental information document, and they can help that community then get through the federal application process, either through the state revolving fund or through rural development. And so we are able to access money through the Indian Health Service Sanitation Facilities Construction Program to get a pro rata share for a project based on the number of Indian homes that are in that community. And then CU helps that community get the funding necessary to do the part of the project that's not eligible for the Indian Health Service funding. The great thing is, you know, all of the IHS funding is a grant. Sometimes we can stack some tribal funds on top of that to increase the grant. That minimizes that amount of loan that the community may have to take out to get the project done, and that helps keep those rates down, like we talked about earlier, and help that system be sustainable and charge a rate, but not have to set aside so much of that rate for the debt service that's required for the loan. It's really been a win-win for us because it's that trusted partner that we can go into that community with. They can help that community at no charge. They do all of that work absolutely free, just like we do. We can go out and then try to find those tribally specific set aside funds for the water and wastewater, and then Communities Unlimited can go out and help them find the non-tribal element of that project. So it's been great, and we couldn't do what we do without CU.
You know, it's that Venn diagram that you were talking about earlier. The overlap is where the magic happens, you know?
Absolutely. Right down there in the core in the middle.
Mr. Hicks, we're getting towards the end of our podcast time here, but I do want to give you a little bit of time to talk about what the future looks like in your field. What are we working on?
Well, you know, the last few years we have had the bipartisan infrastructure law. We've had the American Rescue Plan Act. We've had our regular funding. We've been inundated with project fundings, and it's a good problem to have. We've had more money in the last few years to dedicate to water and wastewater infrastructure than we probably have had in the previous 20. Our challenge in the next few years is trying to get that money out the door. The ARPA money, of course, has deadlines. We have to get those projects under development and committed by the end of next year and expended by the end of 2026. So we've got those time horizons that are rapidly approaching in a water and wastewater project. If you haven't gotten it scoped and gotten the engineering report and stuff done, we're getting to the point where it's not going to be able to be committed to that project by the end of 2024. So we're trying to find shovel-ready projects that we can have on the list that if some more of these funds come loose because we're approaching the deadline, we can get those funded and get the money out the door. As far as Mankiller SOAP, you know, we're approaching that second report cycle, and we're going to have good data for all the systems where we've done the initial evaluation, and then we're going to try to go in and do some work based on the data that we find. So what we want to do is, you know, take those systems that have the lower technical, managerial, and financial capacity scores and work with them to try to get those deficits corrected, try to find where the gaps are that they have in their capacity, you know, whether it be in training or in policies or whatever, and try to bolster them and get their scores up and be sustainable in the long run. So we're going to see that kind of start to play out. The other thing is we've got a couple of really high-level things that are happening at the federal level. One is the lead service line inventories. Lead service line, you know, was a big thing that happened because of the Flint, Michigan crisis, and now every water system in the United States has to conduct an inventory of the service lines in their system. And that's not only the service line on the water district side of the meter, that's the service line on the customer side of the meter as well, which in the past has never been the responsibility of the water system. That's always been just the customer's responsibility. But under this lead service line inventory, the water district is going to be responsible for surveying that entire line from the water main to the meter and from the meter to the house. So we are working with EPA, and glad to say we just received some grant funding. We are going to help all of the small public water systems in the Cherokee Reservation get that lead service line inventory done before the deadline, which is October 16th of 2024. So it's coming quick. And the other issue is emerging contaminants. And the big thing is PFAS. The bad thing is we don't know what we don't know. And right now, we really don't know the level of PFAS contamination because there simply hasn't been a lot of testing done. What my desire is in the next coming months and years is to try to get a lot of sampling done to try to find out where there are issues and get ahead of the curve so we can have solutions ready to go when money comes down to implement those solutions. Because a lot of our small systems, if a small system has to add some type of additional treatment to their water treatment plant, I don't even know if it's going to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. It will probably depend on the type of treatment and the scale, but those systems aren't going to just be able to go to the bank and write a check for that. But until they do, they're going to be out of compliance, and we're going to have out of compliance water systems all over the reservation. That's my fear, and we're going to have to be able to stand in that gap and help them get over that hump and get those solutions implemented. So those are the things that keep me up at night, PFAS and those emerging contaminants. And hopefully we'll be able to get some good sampling done here in the next, 12, 18 months and try to find out where the problems are, and then start working on what the solutions are going to be to get it fixed.
Your to-do list is not very short, is it?
No, it is. It is not. It is very long, and that's just the three things I can think of. If we had a couple of more hours on this podcast, I'm sure I could give you a lot more things on my list. But those are the big things right now: the lead service line inventories and the PFAS emergent contaminant issue.
You know, one of the things that I hear from our environmental services team quite a bit is that one of the challenges they face is getting younger, fresher blood into the water and wastewater field. Do you have any thoughts on that as it relates to the Cherokee Nation? Is that the same challenge?
It is. I think that's a universal challenge. One thing that I think that the Cherokee Nation probably has that we can use to our benefit is we have a lot of Cherokees that were probably like me that would like to have a good job but don't want to move to the East or West Coast. They want to stay home. That type of a job gives you the ability to stay in your home community and make a difference and to be a public health professional, which is what water and wastewater operators are. They're public health professionals, and to make a difference in their home communities. And so, there's been a lot of movement at the federal level to try to encourage folks to get into the water and wastewater field through apprenticeship programs and even pre-apprenticeship programs that they're working on now at the high school level. What I would like for us to do is to, play a role in that. We have a career services program that helps people train for careers in different fields. And I don't see why water and wastewater couldn't be one of those. And we could partner with a lot of folks that are currently doing water and wastewater apprenticeship work and training and recruitment and trying to get folks to enter those fields. And we certainly have the contacts, with all the water systems across the reservation where we could help place those folks when they graduated from that program. I use this example all the time. When you go to a convention of water operators, what you commonly see are a bunch of old guys like me in overalls, and now a lot of them are using canes. And these are the guys that are having, if there's a leak, they got to get down the ditch and fix the leak. They're simply nearing the end of the ability to do that. And we've got to try to recruit younger, more tech savvy folks, because a lot of the water technology is coming up, and it's all cloud based, and it's all used from your phone and from your computer. And those old guys, they're old school. They want things that you can control with a wrench and a dial up telephone, and the new stuff isn't that way. So getting that younger blood into the system, getting those guys trained by those professionals, because that's what they are. They're professionals. And those guys that have got 40 years of experience, you don't replace that overnight. They've got to have some time to mentor those younger folks that are coming along with what they've learned over their career, so that, when they eventually do retire, those folks that are going to take their place have got that skill set built in, and they're able to pick up where they left off and carry on with business. So we're all in favor of that.
Billy Hicks, who serves on the board at RCAP, the board at Communities Unlimited, also the senior director of the Office of Environmental Health and Engineering with the Cherokee Nation. One thing we can work on, let's get you a shorter title.
Yeah. Well, we could just say, senior director OEH&E. That's what we do around here.
Well, yeah, we love our acronyms too. Yeah. I can't remember them all.
Yeah. TLAs, three-letter acronyms.
Well, I appreciate your time. Haley, thank you for your time as well and your input into the discussion, because it was vital and to get that first-person perspective,
Yeah, and thank you for having me. And again, thank you, Billy, for talking.
Absolutely. And it was great to meet you, Haley and Chris. Thank you for this, and thank you for everything.
You're listening to Small Talk with Communities Unlimited. We will have a new fresh episode for you in a couple of weeks.